In the process of evolution, we have noted that there needs to be a continuing development from a simple form to a complex form. And we have also noticed in our past studies that the cell consists of many different systems operating together. The film strip on DNA exposed you to some of the chemical nature of the information system. In order for an organism to develop from a simpler form to a more complex form, or in order for an organism to change at all, somehow the information system must be changed. The author Avers, in our text, talks about how the information system has to have a storage capacity, has to have a transfer capacity, the ability to replicate itself, and then it must have what is called a mutation potential. These are the topics that we will discuss today, and how can an organism change? To begin with, we must have some definitions. The first word we want to define is the word gene. Most of us have had enough exposure to genetics to know that a gene is defined as a portion of the DNA molecule that controls a trait. Now, these traits we know are composed of proteins, and we know that these proteins in their precise arrangements then give us what we are as far as our form and function is concerned. Now, this gene is an intriguing structure composed of this DNA compound that we have studied. We know that it's very stable. We know that it's self-replicating. And we also know that in at least the sexually reproducing organisms, that they appear to operate in pairs, with two genes controlling a trait. The main theory, as it is now, is called the one gene, one enzyme theory, or the one protein theory. And this gene, then, as it causes the formation of a particular enzyme, and these enzymes are then in control of certain reactions, and the control of these reactions give us our form and function. When you get then all the literally hundreds of thousands of different proteins and enzymes all operating in their particular form, we have structure and we have function. It is not known yet whether the life that exists in this form and function is a result of the gene activity, or if the gene activity simply supplements whatever that life is, because we do not know what life is. Now, of course, Gregor Mendel is the man that we give the credit for at least initiating our modern study of genetics. And we have already saw that he found out that certain genes were dominant, certain genes were recessive. We have found since then that sometimes genes are not dominant or recessive, sometimes they blend, and that genes have various interesting characteristics. But the important question that we want to consider today is, how did these genes come up with their particular combinations that we have today? In other words, how did an organism get what is called its gene pool? Now, the gene pool, by definition, is simply the collection of genes that a particular species has. We have a complete dichotomy of thought on the formation of the gene pool as far as the evolutionists and the creationists are concerned. The evolutionist believes that the gene pool began as a very simple collection of nucleotides, DNA, RNA material, and that through random collection, random accident, other processes like these, that the gene pool became more and more complex, having more and more variety. The creationist, on the other hand, usually seems to have the view that in God's original creation, the complete gene pool for a kind, whatever that word means, was created by God in the initial creation. And that the gene pool, although it of course has changed since the creation of man, has not led to a greater complexity of an organism, but actually a lesser complexity. In other words, the creationist is saying that the gene pool is becoming less viable, whereas the evolutionist is saying it is becoming more viable, giving more and more variation as it changes. Now, this complete difference in thought needs to be examined, because underlying this particular view, or these particular views of the gene pool, is, of course, the whole thrust of evolution. Is it possible that genes can change? If they can change, what kind of changes do they perpetuate? Are these changes giving more diversity, more complexity, or do the changes lead to a less viable, less complex organism? Now, we have some other thoughts that we have to interject at this particular point. For example, even though we're going to be debating the gene pool concept, we have to have some principles or laws. Now, in genetics, there are a couple of principles. And one of these is that an individual of a species will not alternate the species to any great extent. And so when we're talking about gene pool collection here, it really isn't any one particular animal within a species that is bringing about a great amount of change. But all of these animals, as they continue to interbreed, will contribute to the gene pool. See, a gene pool isn't just what one animal has within it, it's what the species as a group have. And then as the animals within the species, or the plants within the species, interbreed, you see, you get different expressions from within that gene pool. No one organism exhibits everything that is in the gene pool for that species. But anyway, as we were saying, this individual will not alternate the species to any great extent, but it will contribute to the gene pool. And this contribution will bring a gradual change in the species. Now, how soon this gradual change occurs depends upon the size of the deme, D-E-M-E. And a deme, by definition, is a localized interbreeding group. This is sort of an important principle here, because if you have a large localized interbreeding group, say this is determined by a mountain range or a local food area, if you have a large group, you have many organisms having input into this gene pool, and it tends then to change very slowly what the species will look like. On the other hand, if you have a small localized interbreeding group, then you have very few animals having input into the gene pool, and therefore it is easier for changes in the genes to be expressed. An example of this, I feel, is the Galapagos Islands, where we have Darwin's finches. One of the major convincing points of poor Darwin in his thinking along the evolutionary lines was the variety of finches that he found in the Galapagos Islands. Tremendous variety. And he could not explain these, so he began to question then his idea as to the fixity of the species, as it was called in those days. He had been taught in church that the species does not change. The word kind in scriptures meant species, and that God had created all the kinds, therefore he had created all the species. There was no change in these. When he came to Galapagos, he simply could not correlate what he saw with what he'd been taught. And this conflict led him then to reject what he'd been taught in church, and to move then to his original theory of evolution, which, of course, we've modified today. Now, I think what we see in the Galapagos Islands is actually that somehow, through some type of a migration or a storm or something, that a small group of finches landed there, and then through close family interbreeding, we had the expression of the extremes very quickly. And then these extremes tended to isolate these birds. Now, there's no question that these were all finches. The question, or the problem, was that there was such a variety in their shapes. Their beaks were quite a bit different, their size was different, their eating habits were different. And I think what we saw there is just an expression of this particular principle, that when you have a small deme with few animals having input to the gene pool, you can get rapid expression of extremes. This is one reason why we have laws against close family intermarriage, because we know that when you have close family or marriage, first cousin or closer, that extremes tend to be expressed more rapidly, especially in the area of mental problems, insanity problems, physical problems. So this is an illustration of this first particular principle. Now, it's interesting that in genetics we have a law or a principle called the Hardy-Weinberg law. Hardy-Weinberg. Weinberg is spelled W-E-I-N-B-E-R-G. This particular principle in genetics states that the expression of the gene pool will move towards equilibrium, losing the extremes, or becoming stable, unless there are driving mechanisms. Now here we have a paradox for the evolutionist, because any time, according to the Hardy-Weinberg principle, you have extremes, these will tend to be absorbed through interbreeding of the group here, and all the organisms will tend to look more and more like each other as long as they interbreed. It follows the bell curve that we're familiar with in giving curves for tests or in using statistics, is that the majority of organisms will basically fall into the same category, will look alike. So the Hardy-Weinberg law in genetics then says that this gene pool, in spite of the extremes that it has in it, will move towards an equilibrium. And the changes or the extremes, which we would expect mutations to be, would somehow be lost. So what we want to do now is to examine what are the driving mechanisms that would then cause this Hardy-Weinberg law to be offset, that would tend to then allow changes. Because in evolution, you have to have something that allows changes. To go from the amoeba to man, you have to have many changes, and these have to be allowed through some driving mechanism. And we're going to examine different ones. Now the first one, and the most important one, as far as I'm concerned, is mutation. Now, in 1901, DeVries came out, D-E-V-R-I-E-S, came out with a mutation theory that became the basis, really, and is very similar to what we study today as mutation. Mutation, by definition, is any change, any inheritable change, in the genetic structure. Now, many books make the statement, for example, Dillon, that we used to use in our evolution class, makes the statement that all organisms would be identical, except for mutations. Avers talks about this, page 104 and page 106, that mutations are so extremely important to the changes. Well, many men have made statements, for example, in the mid-50s, some of our main voices in evolution made the statements that mutation was the major force in evolution. But the interesting thing is that as we have studied genetics, we found that mutation rates are so slow and so limited that they do not collect at any rate that is fast enough to produce what is needed in evolution, that they have come out in more recent years saying that, well, mutation isn't so important at all. There's some other force like natural selection or something like that. In fact, today, natural selection is considered the major force instead of mutation. But let's examine mutation here a little bit, because in essence, the only way an organism can be different is that its information system is different. And by definition, a change in that information system, which is inheritable, is a mutation. And mutations can happen on many levels. They can happen on the molecular level. You can have something happening within the DNA strand itself. We would call these point mutations. Here would be a situation where during the replication process, there would be a foul-up due to a pH change or heat or radiation, because DNA and RNA both are very susceptible during their replication stages to chemical problems. So we can call these point mutations. We can have larger mutations. The gene itself can be rearranged, or the chromosome can be rearranged. And we have certain types of things that can happen. We can have, for example, what is called a chiasmata, C-H-I-A-S-M-A-T-A, chiasmata. Chiasmata is a crossing over. For example, when the DNA molecule or the chromosome are wrapped around each other and they cross over What would happen is that as they would try to separate during the mitosis or the meiosis process, as they would start separating or pulling apart, especially during meiosis in the tetrad where they're all wrapped around each other, that pieces would break. And you might have the tail of one attaching with the head of the other. Well, that's a chiasmata. That's a crossing over, where different halves cross over to different sections. Or we can have deletion, where a piece is simply broken off and lost. And there are different things that we have found, for example, that are a direct result of breaking off. We find out that, for example, mongoloidism is when a portion of the 21st chromosome breaks off and is left as an extra chromosome in another cell. And so mongoloidism is due to, or Down syndrome, I should call it, is due to the presence of an extra chromosome that has been broken off or deleted, you see. There are a number of them like that that we could talk about. Sometimes we get duplication, or polyploidy, it's called, duplication, where for some reason an extra chromosome ends up in the cell, a full chromosome. Or we can get inversion, where a chromosome that is, as it's duplicating, may break in half, and then it may recombine, but when it recombines, one end of it will be turned upside down. And so instead of giving an ABCD type of a progression, you might have an ABDC, because there's an inversion where the broken part has come off and then joined back in. Or sometimes we get a complete translocation, where a piece breaks off, and this piece is moved completely to a different chromosome, and attaches on that completely different chromosome. That's a translocation, a change of location there. Now, we know these happen. We can observe these happening. We can predict that they will happen at different rates. An average rate, for example, in humans is that about 1 per million cell divisions would produce some type of a mutation. And since we are producing literally millions of cells every day in our continual process of death and life in our bodies, you can see that there are a fair number of mutations. Now, some cells mutate more than others, some mutate less. Mutation is more important to change in non-sexual organisms, because a non-sexual organism, when it duplicates itself, would duplicate that mutation. And so, on the non-sexual level, mutations can be propagated fairly rapidly, and you can get some new things happening. So this is why in diseases, bacteria, etc. like this, they can change and new forms can arise, and we're continually, in medicine, fighting this battle of changing asexual or non-sexual organisms. But now, sexual reproduction tends to eliminate these mutations as far as perpetuating them to your offspring is concerned. A number of reasons. One is that, of course, in sex, you have the special cells formed by the male and by the female. And these cells, as they are formed, tend to eliminate weaker forms, which the mutation often is. Also, in the sexual process, it's usually a rigorous process where only the most hardy survive. And again, because of the nature of mutations being a damage, it'd be very rare that a damage would give you a stronger form, and so they tend to be self-eliminated in sex protection. Plus, when you have two different organisms coming together, what is the probability that they would both have the same mutation, and that this mutation then could match up in sexual reproduction? It would be, for all practical purposes, impossible. So sex tends to protect against the propagation of these mutations. Well, what effect do these have? Well, even the evolutionists admit that there's very, very little good that could come out of these. At the very least, or at the very most, whichever way you want to put it here, they calculate that probably 99.98% of mutations are disruptive. Our author Abers, for example, makes the statement that if you would drop an ice pick into a fine Swiss watch, you would expect it normally to hurt the watch. But if for some particular reason the ice pick would hit a speck of dust on the flywheel and knock the speck of dust off, then the watch could run more accurately. And this is the same category, then, of helpful mutations. Most of them are considered harmful, 99.98% at the very least. Now, The rest of them, then, the 0.02% here that we're talking about, can be divided into two categories, either no effect or beneficial. And I can make this particular statement that, according to Dr. Gish at least, and according to what I can read, there has never been observed in nature a beneficial mutation. We only have really one study that we can go to, and one study situations are very weak. But Dobonsky, D-O-B-Z-A-N-S-K-Y, Dobonsky did some studies looking for beneficial mutations. And he used the fruit fly, because the fruit fly goes through its complete life cycle in 3 weeks. You can go through a breeding cycle in about 13 to 15 days. So by using fruit flies, then you can very rapidly go through a number of generations. Well, he went through 10,000 generations of fruit flies, and he bombarded these fruit flies with radiation, which increases the mutation rate about 10 times. So in essence, we're talking about 100,000 generations of fruit flies, which is more generations than humans have supposedly had. He got all kinds of interesting results. He had all kinds of fruit flies. He had, of course, those which were dead, white eyes, red eyes, brown eyes, barred eyes, round eyes, big eyes, small eyes. He had different numbers of bristles or hairs on the chest. He would have 3 hairs, 7 hairs, 11 hairs, curly hairs, straight hairs, short hairs, long hairs. He had long wings, short wings, curly wings, flat wings, narrow wings, all kinds of variation. They were all fruit flies, which is intriguing. But he had quite a bit of variation, and so he did show that mutation has an effect on the organism. But he was looking for beneficial mutations. And the only thing he could find in all these thousands upon millions of fruit flies is that he found 2 fruit flies, which he said had beneficially mutated. And these 2 fruit flies had the ability to withstand a 5-degree higher temperature than the other fruit flies. We have a lot of discussion on beneficial mutations. We're continually being told about how insects are changing, becoming pesticide resistant, how diseases are becoming antibiotic resistant or serum resistant. The trouble is, this is all by definition and not by observation, because we do not know how some organisms become resistant. It is entirely possible that in the original gene pool there are certain ones that were resistant from the very beginning, and that these are the ones that are surviving who have been resistant all along and simply filling in where the population that is now dead was. We have one experiment that shows this. And that is the experiment that way back in the early 40s, late 30s, when penicillin was being developed, to help us with our venereal disease problems. And we would use different things, and we would bombard bacteria, these venereal disease bacteria, with these different antibiotics. And as a result, we'd find out which helped and which did not. Well, of course, penicillin was discovered. And we found then that this penicillin did kill the venereal diseases, especially syphilis and gonorrhea. Now, when we first began giving shots of penicillin, we could give 10,000 units of penicillin using their medical measurement, and we could somewhat control the venereal disease, at least hold it in check. Today, we're giving 4 million units to achieve the same result. And there are some people that are even taking higher than that. Anything after 4 million, you're beginning to perhaps create problems with irritability and allergy reactions. So what we have now are resistant strains. But the question is, are these strains resistant because they developed a resistance, or were there some in the original that were already resistant, and these have simply filled in where the others were killed? We had one experiment, and again, whenever you're working with ones, it's extremely poor scientifically. But I find it intriguing, at least, and enough, at least, to call the idea into question. This one culture of the venereal disease had never been exposed to penicillin, and had been fast frozen and was kept until the mid-50s. And they brought this culture out, and decided to do some experimentation with it to try to observe mutation, you see. They took the original culture, propagated it, so you had a large collection there, and they bombarded it with the penicillin. And what they found was intriguing. In the first bombardment with penicillin, most of the germs were killed. But in the first bombardment, there were a few that were survived. Now, on the first bombardment, it would have to be a natural resistance. You could not develop a resistance that quickly, at least through any mechanism that we know of. But in the first bombardment, there were some that survived. These then propagated themselves and filled in where the others had died. Now, getting back to the gene pool concept, does this illustrate the creationist viewpoint or the evolutionist viewpoint? The creationist viewpoint in that in the original created gene pool, all the variations, major variations were there. We do not deny that there have been changes. But what is the extent of these changes, you see? Or is it according to the evolutionist viewpoint that organisms are developing resistance, developing greater abilities? Now, to be totally honest, we're not totally clear on how all our genetic systems work as yet. We know they're very stable. They do not like to change. It is calculated that, for example, a mutation in the genes in humans would take at least 10,000 years to be firmly established in the human population. So genes are slow to change. C.H. Waddington says that we have sort of a lunatic sort of logic in this. It's a little bit like if you had a 14-line sonnet and you change one letter at a time, throw out all the bad words, and you would end up with Shakespeare. You see, to take communication, chemical communication, and through random changes make it more logical is an illogical type of interpretation. So, since there has never been observed in nature a beneficial mutation, there are some that are there and that are defined to be mutations, we just have to question, we have to challenge whether mutation is a driving force for the Hardy-Weinberg principle. And again, even the evolutionists have backed off in using this, but it is the only way that an organism can change. A second type of driving mechanism is differential migration. And this is where you get a particular concentration of gene expression, and they leave. Now, this might be due to color, or to size, or some other fairly obvious type of a structure. For example, in human cultures, we separate by color. And so maybe other organisms do this, and then after they separate into their social groups, they simply migrate to a new area. But the thing is that differential migration, or as Avers calls it, gene flow, this does not put anything new into the gene pool. This simply isolates small segments. And so you might get a Darwin's thrush here to isolate itself because of its beak or its food structure here, but it's still a finch, you see. No change in kinds. By the way, the word kinds, I feel, in Scripture means family, not species. Because we can change species. We can change their colors, their shapes. We can do it with tomatoes quite easily. But the family grouping, we have had no changes that we know of. No record in the fossils, no observed changes at all in the families. The third category, and this one's not in Avers, but this is called genetic drift. And by definition, this is called a strong deviation in your expected ratios. When you do genetic crosses, we do a lot of prediction as to what the ratio of offspring will be, if it's a 9-3-3-1 or a 6-3-2-2 and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes you get a strong deviation from this particular ratio. We don't know what causes it. And really, to be honest, there's no evidence for this, according to Savage in his book on evolution. And Dillon in his book says it's just probably just a sampling error. So genetic drift isn't a major driving mechanism. And like I said, it's not a neighbor's, but it is one that can be considered here, where something happens. Maybe it's a strong bombardment of radiation, and so you get a different grouping all of a sudden. This would have its extreme in Goldschmidt's hopeful monster mechanism, where a reptile lays an egg, and while he's laying that egg, or forming that egg, something radical happens to it, and when the egg hatches, you have a bird. You see, you got a strong genetic drift. Fourth category is natural selection. Now, natural selection is now the major driving mechanism for change. And natural selection is, well, traditionally has been called the survival of the fittest. They're moving away from that type of word, but in essence, that's what they mean. Natural selection or survival of the fittest is one of those round robin definition things that is characteristic in a lot of evolutionary literature. When you say something is fit, you say it survives because it reproduces. And so you kind of define, you say it's fit because it reproduces, and it reproduces because it's fit. And so round and round you go. As long as it survives, then it must be fit. And so it's called a tautology, tautology, where your definition is such that it cannot include anything but what is actually there. I don't know why they have gone so strongly to natural selection. In fact, in a lecture by George Wall, the Nobel laureate, that when he was in Seattle, he spelled natural selection with a capital N, because he said this is now the god or the priest or whatever you want to call it of the evolutionary movement. But the intriguing thing is that natural selection does not change the genetics of the organism. The only thing natural selection will do will change the expression of these. In other words, natural selection would tend to isolate out those things that can breed and can reproduce and can survive, but it would not make them more able to survive or just more able to breed. So it's kind of an intriguing thing. I don't know why they've carried so much strength on this. The melanin moth is probably the best example of natural selection in illustrating what I'm trying to get across here, and that is the melanin moth, of course, is the moth that was supposedly white on its wings, and it lived on the birch and the aspen in England. And then as the revolution, industrial revolution came along, the soot covered the trees, and so the melanin moth changed from the white wing to the speckled wing and finally to the dark wing. And this was a change in itself so it could survive. Well, this is natural selection. But what we find out is that really there are three varieties, not species, but varieties of the melanin moth. And it appears there always has been, that we have white moths, we have speckled moths, and we have the dark moths. All are melanin moths. And what has actually happened is that natural selection shifted the size of the populations. As the white ones could no longer hide, the birds ate them. And so the dark ones, because they were hidden now with the soot on the trees, they survived in greater numbers. And so the population size shifted. You didn't create a new species. We didn't change anything. We simply changed the population size of those that were already there. And when all natural selection does is change population sizes, how can it give rise then to new species, new families, go from the amoeba to the man? Now, actually, natural selection tends to be a stabilizing force rather than a dividing or a creating of new force. So I don't know how natural selection can explain, but it does seem to be the major force that is being used as explanation now in your books, and you can read this in Avers on page 131. The fifth category has to do with size of population. We've already discussed this, in that the smaller the population you have, the more variety that you can get in a hurry. And number six, a very, very minor one, not usually accepted, but I will mention it, and this is the system of mating. If you do have a system of mating where the dominant. A male, for example, is the only one that breeds, then it would be possible to isolate his particular traits. But in a lot of the societies, like the monkey societies or whatever, chickens, pigeons, are very characteristic in birds, a lot of societies which seem to actually breed along this, when the truth is finally told, we find that the lesser males are allowed, as long as they sneak around, to breed, and so the system of mating really is an inconsistent type of a driving mechanism. Well, there we have the six driving mechanisms, and as we can see, really, mutation is the only one that brings about a change in the information system, and there is just really no information that shows that mutation can do the job that is necessary. With this, then, we're really left, because if mutation does not bring about the change that is needed, what does? And the evolutionist has to simply answer, well, perhaps it is this, or perhaps it is that, and he's always looking for new methods. Now, they are doing a tremendous amount of research now in the genetics area. We are finding out more and more about this, and it may be that these systems are more changeable than we know. But in the latest literature that I can find, that I can read, and that is that the systems, the DNA systems, are extremely stable. In fact, there's evidence that I've read put out by Watson and some of these others. I shouldn't say Watson, I should say Crick. And they are showing that these systems are somewhat self-correcting even. That if a mutation does come along, that the DNA sequences tend to isolate themselves and to correct themselves. And so it appears that this DNA molecule is extremely stable, extremely sturdy, and simply does not allow any changes. Now, we have to be careful when we read about these changes, because since the evolutionist says, well, they must have occurred, they just put them right in the literature. They don't have to defend them, you know. They're just there. And you have to be careful with the words that you get. For example, the word adaptation is consistently used to mean these types of changes, which we have not found to be existent. Now, adaptation is a real thing. We adapt to sunlight by tanning. Or we adapt to cold by putting clothes on. These are adaptations, things that are built into the organism that he can respond then to some kind of stimuli and survive better. That's an adaptation. But animals and organisms and plants can only adapt to the extent that they have the information system for the change. They cannot program themselves for new things. For example, the story goes that the Rocky Mountain goat decided to move higher and higher, so for survival purposes. And when it got up in the high mountains, got into the ice, it was very slick, very cold. And so the Rocky Mountain goat adapted by growing hair on its feet. And this hair would keep their feet warm, plus it would keep them from slipping when they would jump on the ice. Well, there is no way that any organism can, through any kind of conscious effort, direct its evolutionary process, its mutation process. That's a very sound principle taught in all your genetics books. There is no way that you can influence exact mutations. We can increase the rate of mutations. That's true. We can bombard people with x-rays or stuff like this, and we can increase the mutation rates, but we cannot direct it. Even with all our technology, we cannot direct it. We are just now breaking into controlled mutation with our recombinant DNA research that we're doing. But an animal through conscious thought cannot do this. So the word adaptation can only be used to explain something that is programmed into our information systems. It is not to be used to explain new techniques or information. So we might ask ourselves, how did this theory of change get started? I think it's important that we understand that Darwin and Mendel were contemporaries, and they both published about the same time, which means that Darwin had no exposure to the modern genetic theory at all. In fact, modern genetic theory was not really developed until 1930s. It wasn't discovered till After the 1900s, Mendel's work was brought out. So what did Darwin believe? Well, Darwin believed in what is called pangenesis. And pangenesis was the theory that there were pangenes, as they were called, from all parts of the body. In other words, every part of your body would contribute to the fluid that was mixed in the sexual process. And so you can see how he could accept change very rapidly, that if a person had an arm cut off, then that arm could not contribute a fluid. You see, and so then the fluid, when it combined, may or may not combine to produce an arm. It depends on whether the mother or the father, whichever one it was here, but the one with the arm, had enough fluid to cover for the one that did not have the fluid. And so with this kind of an attitude, you can see how these kind of changes could be accepted very rapidly by Darwin, because that's what he had been taught. Someone would have their tonsils cut out, they wouldn't be able to produce fluids for tonsils. Someone would have a toe cut off, they wouldn't have fluid for toes. If someone developed huge muscles, they would have more contribution of muscles, and so their child would have great muscles. And so this is what Darwin was picking up on then in his studies, that organisms could develop something, and then after they had developed it, they would secrete juices or pangenes for it, and then this would bring about the change. So I think it's important for us to realize that this was Darwin's teaching. This was his conviction at the time, that pangenesis was the method of genetics. Now, the intriguing thing to me is that the more we study genetics, the less possible we see that genetics is the force that drives mutation. And yet, there hasn't been any backing off at all. So we're left with this theory of evolution, which has tremendous amounts of time, because hopefully, I shouldn't use that word perhaps, but hopefully, beneficial mutations could occur, but they're going to occur very, very slowly. And this is one reason why we have had to have tremendous amount of time. We're projecting 2 million years, 3 million years, 4.6 billion years, and some are projecting 10 and even 20 billion years now for the age of the Earth, because they need time to survive. Now, there are a number of other things that we could go into at this particular point, but I think this will do for this particular lecture, which covers in the driving mechanisms and the forces that bring about change.